Campus Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're close to having another series of Democratic Party primary elections coming up around the country. And, of course, our own here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana will be on May 5th. But as recently as last Friday, Joe Kahn, who is a retired journalist and then covers not only a lot of time he spent covering local politics at the Post-Tribune, but also in dealing with IT issues and healthcare issues as well as a journalist, had a chance to talk with off-mic host Michael Puente about the topic. And here's the conversation.
Well, Iowa is over. New Hampshire is in the books. Up next is the Nevada caucuses next Saturday, and then off to South Carolina for the Democratic presidential candidates. Indiana doesn't get to vote until May, so we've got a long way to wait. But not as, you know, Illinois is actually a little bit sooner in March 17th. So what are all these candidates doing to drum up support here in these Midwestern states while we have to wait voting? Local supporters are the candidate. These are actually out trying to drum up support for their candidate. And joining me now in studio to talk about the person he's supporting is Joe Kahn, local political campaign official. Joe, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, Michael.
Well, you're sort of in the camp for Bernie Sanders. What is it, somebody who is helping the Bernie Sanders campaign? What are you doing right now in terms of Midwest Indiana?
Well, they have hit the ground running in Northwest Indiana, unlike 4 years ago. I remember it was at one of the first organizing meetings in Griffith in March, and they had to actually open up a door, a vacant shop on the main drag there in Griffith, because they were going to have it in a coffee shop, and 200 people showed up, and they were just completely flabbergasted how many people were supporting Bernie. But they didn't get going until maybe April with a local office here, and already people are out there working really, really hard for him. So doing call-ins and out of state, and a ton of people from Northwest Indiana drove over to Iowa. I went over to Iowa, spent a day there with a friend, Elaine Kofi, and we knocked on doors in some little town called Lost Nation. So they're already in full battle mode.
You know, Bernie is really not as a stranger to Northwest Indiana as people might think. I remember covering Bernie on some of his visits to the south side of Chicago. He's come to Gary a couple of times. Even before, I mean, people were like saying, this guy Bernie Sanders, this Vermont senator, was going to be running for president. And you're thinking, who? But that's how it's developed. And he just had the day that Pete Buttigieg declared his candidacy for the president last fall, Bernie was in Gary. He was talking to folks.
Right.
So he's not as unfamiliar of the terrain over here as people might think.
I met Bernie Sanders at a Beer with Bernie event at the back of a bar room on the south side of Chicago. He'd come into south side to campaign for Susan Sadlowski Garza, who you know is Eddie Sadlowski's daughter, big steelworker district director. He fit right in. He's got ties to this area pretty tight. He was also campaigning for Chuy Garcia up in Chicago. It took time, and they packed the house there at the old steelworkers' local headquarters right on Avenue O across from the memorial, the Republic Steel Massacre Memorial. So, yeah, he's very aware of this area.
You know, Joe, when, you know, you're no different than me or other folks, we're all looking at the same coverage in terms of what happened in Iowa and now the outcome in New Hampshire. But it's gotta help in terms of Bernie Sanders' support that he won the New Hampshire primary as the declared winner, as opposed to say somebody like Joe Biden, who, what do his supporters do now that he's had two poor showings out there?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was telling that Joe he bypassed Nevada and went straight to South Carolina, and that's going to be on the 29th. The population in South Carolina, the majority of the Democratic Party are African Americans in South Carolina, and he thinks that he has a firewall. He's used that word a number of times to keep his slide, halt his slide. But his campaign is in real trouble.
Yeah, I mean, if let's say, for example, yeah, you keep racking up these sort of losses, and that's what kind of hurt Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. She kept losing primaries to Bernie Sanders, and you couldn't keep doing that. So let's say Bernie Sanders came out of Iowa or New Hampshire limping, you may not be sitting here so confident.
Oh, no, if he hadn't done well in Iowa and hadn't done well in New Hampshire, he'd be over. It's going to be a war. This is a marathon, not a sprint race, and it's going to be a war not just for, you know, the candidate Sanders. It's going to be a war, I think, for the heart and soul of the party. I am not a Democrat. I am a Green, and so right now we don't have a candidate yet, and we probably won't want to have one on the ballot here. Our convention is until the summer, so right now I'm working for Bernie because he's in favor of Medicare for All. I founded the Northwest Indiana Medicare for All group, and I think we need that in this country. We have anywhere between 18,000 and 44,000 people here dying for lack of health insurance, and we just have to do this. And Bernie's the most outstanding of several Democrats right now that are supportive of Medicare for All. He actually has the bill. So,
Joe, is there any kind of do you feel any conflict or division knowing that Pete Buttigieg is a Hoosier and is right down the road in South Bend, that by all accounts, he's still, I mean, surprising to a lot of folks that he's up there still as a viable candidate.
Yeah, it's somewhat startling that a mayor of a city the size of South Bend is doing as well as he is doing. But he's a very smart guy, and he's managed to attract a lot of money. There's been a lot of controversy of where that money's coming from, corporations and such. But I don't have any sort of leanings towards Buttigieg at all, because I'm looking at what he's for, and he's for something called Medicare for All Who Want It. It's a warmed over public option, and I spent an hour on Wednesday evening talking to our Medicare for All group. I did research for 2 days on that, and the public option is a fugazi. It's not even a real thing that would work. It's not designed to get everybody covered. At best, it's they hope that it'll be the camel's nose under the tent, that one day we end up with Medicare for All, but it really won't work that way.
Well, we've been talking about some of the local support for the presidential candidates. We've had, the Iowa caucuses happening, and the New Hampshire primaries are already behind us now, and we're gearing up now for Nevada and South Carolina, and we're talking to a local supporter of Bernie Sanders. But joining us on the phone right now is Josh Kilroy, who's from Chicago, who's helping the campaign of Amy Klobuchar. Josh, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, Josh, let me ask you this. We've been hearing a lot about Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. But with some of the how Amy Klobuchar has been performing, she's getting a lot of national play. She's doing better than a lot of people expected. Why are you in her camp?
Sure. And let me just clarify. I have a PAC that is independent of her campaign. I do not coordinate with her or am authorized by her in any. So I just want to be clear about that.
Sure.
Sure. So I find that the senator has been a voice for moderation and, a pragmatic voice in the Senate. And I think that in this age of Donald Trump, that is exactly what we need in the White House. I think she's got a long, solid track record on the issues. I think she has the experience. And I think she has the temperament that we need right now.
She is from the Midwest, but we haven't heard too much about her in the Chicagoland area. And this is sort of the first I've heard, of this sort of support. What do you think her support is like in, say, Illinois?
Sure. I should mention, first of all, that she does have ties to Illinois. She graduated from the University of Chicago Law School back in 1985. So she knows our area well, here in Illinois and in Northwest Indiana. And so, you know, she understands our values. And, you know, the reason I started this PAC was, you know, I saw her performance in the debate last Friday and had made exactly the same observation you made. Boy, you know, there's no presence here, and they should do something about that. And then, you know, it occurred to me they're probably focused on South Carolina and Nevada. And, you know, I've worked on many campaigns. So I figured I should do it. And so I put this PAC together, and we're going to try to create a presence here in the Midwest over the next few months. We have the primary coming up in Illinois on March 17th. We have a primary in Wisconsin, April 7th. Michigan has a primary March 10th. And Indiana has a primary on May 5th. And historically, the primary in Indiana has never been too much of a factor. But with the fractured field, the Indiana primary could end up being pivotal.
You're right about that. And also the last few presidential primaries have gone on so long that Indiana has been sort of a factor, going all the way back to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton duking it out all the way past May, and them almost being residents of Northwest Indiana that we hear so much.
Right.
So how would Amy Klobuchar's message, I mean, really, if you look at the field right now, she really is sort of that moderate voice in the field. But do you think people are going to gravitate to moderation? It seems like they want extremes.
Well, you know, I think the voices further out on the edge tend to be the loudest voices. But, you know, I think most people are looking for a change in not just policies from the current White House, but a change in tone and temperament. And I think that Senator Klobuchar is much better positioned provide that. And, you know, in contrast with some of the other sort of voices that are lumped in with as moderate, Vice President Biden, you know, does not seem to be getting any traction. And I think as time goes on, Pete Buttigieg's support will weaken. Because, I mean, 37 is quite young to be President of the United States, particularly without, you know, more executive experience than the mayor of a mid-sized town.
But let me ask you this, being the mayor of a mid-sized town, just really 90 minutes just east of Chicago, does that work to Pete Buttigieg's advantage over, say, Amy Klobuchar, who we really haven't heard too much in the Chicagoland area over the years?
Well, you know, I mean, she has a track record on the issues. She has plenty of time to get her message out. And the Midwest, because we tend to vote a little later, a lot of the candidates, you know, are still have to make their appointment. That's where why Bernie has such a big advantage, having gone through this 4 years ago and having, to his credit, maintained a visible presence in the last 4 years.
But
still plenty of time. And we saw that with her surge in New Hampshire. You know, as once people started focusing on the race, most of the late breakers went to Senator Klobuchar.
What do you think Senator Klobuchar's main message is going to be for Midwestern voters in Illinois and Indiana?
Well, that she represents our values. You know, the sort of pragmatic, low-key, common-sense approach that has been synonymous with the Midwest for almost 200 years now. That's her approach, and that approach just happens to be what we need in the White House right now.
All right, Josh. We also have an in-studio guest who's been working on the campaign for Bernie Sanders, Joe Kahn. Joe, when you see Amy Klobuchar gaining in the polls, she did pretty well in New Hampshire. Could you see her more moderate sort of tone giving Bernie trouble in Midwest states?
No, I don't, honestly. The centrist position of the it's a crowded field, and that's been the problem for Klobuchar and all of them. I mean, there's four of them crowded in there: Biden, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and now Bloomberg. I just hope they all cheer each other up for the next two or three primaries and caucuses, and Bernie keeps on winning.
Josh, as creating this super PAC for Amy Klobuchar, what does that all entail, and how does that operate?
Sure. It's a matter of setting up, just filing some paperwork, but it's really, and creating that independence. But then it's just, ordinary campaign activity. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is to help set up some phone banking and, some visibility work, in Chicago starting next week. Typical campaign stuff. Being at the L stops and bus stops with campaign literature, phone banking, knocking on doors if you can.
I have a question. This is Joe. With Bloomberg rising, he's rising pretty fast in the polls, and he's self-financed. Do you think that he might also suck all the money out of the election? Because you guys, you're setting up this PAC for Amy, and Biden, it has been well reported that he's running out of money.
Sure, I'm not concerned about that. I mean, the nice thing about the fact that Bloomberg is self-financing is that precisely that he's not taking money that would otherwise be on the table for other candidates. If he was running an aggressive fundraising operation, I would be more concerned. But I think there's plenty of resources available for candidates like Amy Klobuchar.
You don't think the big money is going to gravitate to the big money? It's not going to attract itself?
I think Bloomberg is a fatally flawed candidate. I think some of his positions, on the stop and frisk, some of the quotes that are now coming up in the news, I think they're deal breakers with Democratic constituencies. So, and there are problems that money can't solve. If he were unknown, the money would be more concerning. But, he has a record of not being very good on labor issues, for one thing, and racial issues, issues of racial equity on another. So, the fact that we're moving into the Midwest, the union vote will be much more of a factor. And I don't think he'll get much traction there at all.
Well, Josh Kilroy is a political strategist out of Chicago. All right, Josh, thank you so much. I want to thank Joe Kahn for coming in studio also as well and pushing the envelope over there for Bernie Sanders' campaign.
And that's Michael Puente talking with Joe Kahn and his guest, an Amy Klobuchar supporter. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Ivy Tech Community College has over time here been expanding the number of courses they offer in their 8-week format. And coming up in March, they are going to be offering a record number of courses that students can take to get their higher education underway and not have to wait until maybe the summer or the fall to find out more about it. Let's check with the president of Ivy Tech Community College, Dr. Sue Elsperman. And Dr. Sue Elsperman, thanks for joining us on the program today.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
For folks that are not familiar with the 8-week format, when did this begin with Ivy Tech Community College, and what were some of the initial thoughts that obviously you found that it's been done so well, you've expanded it over time?
Here's an interesting insight. Forever we've offered summer courses in an 8-week format, and interestingly, students always did a little better in that 8-week format. So 2.5-3 years ago, we did our own research, looked nationally at community colleges that were offering 8-week format as that was beginning to become a little more common. And guess what we found? Every other institution, as they rolled it out, found the same experience. Our students, mostly adult, do better in an 8-week format. You might, by the way, recognize that most MBA and other adult-driven programs are offered in less than 16-week kind of formats because it fits adults better. Mm-hmm. What we saw in many communities colleges see is that week 10 or 12, students kind of just stop showing up. Life gets in the way, their work schedules change, something happens at home, and all of a sudden even though they've made it through half the course successfully, that second half, life gets in the way. So as we saw that study results, we went to study really the best in the country being done in Odessa, Texas, and at Odessa College. They have had moved completely to that format, and in fact, their part-time students were graduating at faster rates than the other Texas community colleges' full-time students. Because when you take a course every 8 weeks, you actually graduate faster as well. So not only did students pass their classes, they were completing at a faster rate.
I understand, too, that it not only helps the students, but it also helps family members, too, of the students.
Absolutely. It gives you a different rhythm. So after 8 weeks, you have a week off. You come back for the next 8 weeks. You have Christmas break. You come back for the next 8 weeks. You have spring break. You come back, and then summer. So it really is it honors a lot of people. Families, employers can also, you know, you can adjust every 8 weeks based on the needs of your work schedule, et cetera. So we are very pleased with that. We now are about 60% of our classes are offered in an 8-week format. It probably will never be 100% because some classes are taught better in 16 weeks, and the student experience and other requirements keep them in that format. But we believe that within the next year, we'll be 75% or more. We've made this 2-year transition, and in fact, to those listening, students do better. Mm-hmm. We see more than 5% increase in pass rates and 2 or 3% lower drop rates every semester, all things that help our students succeed and complete faster and get on with a good career.
Now, does the 8-week format help students that want to take more than one course? Maybe they won't be like the 16-week course for just one class, but they want to take more. So it would be more like an Ivy Tech community college student would be almost more closer to the curriculum load that a regular student at, say, IU or Purdue or Ball State would have.
Yeah, as a part-time student, they will probably take at least 15 credits a year, which is wonderful. And if they can take a little heavier, absolutely, they become closer to a full-time student. And we do, in fact, see that happening. It really is a good opportunity. And as we approach spring, March 16th will be our next spring start. So as we are talking about these 5 times that students can either start school, which, by the way, is another important part of 8-week courses. Instead of having just a fall or a January start, if you will, we now have 5 times a year that students can begin their journey, right? Instead of waiting until next August or waiting until next January, they can actually come in our doors today and be able to start March 16th.
That's right.
And we think that's really important in honoring adults.
Now, how does this change to allow for the March 16th start for courses affect those who are looking for help with FAFSA?
They should come on in today, get that financial aid underway, but also know that you might be aware, and as people are listening, the state has Next Level Jobs, which are many, many programs that are 1 year and less in length, certifications and certificates that lead to high-value jobs that, oh, by the way, then stack into associate degrees and beyond. So there are a myriad of ways that if they come in, we can get them started. But the sooner the better, because financial aid does take a little time to work through it. But if they come in our doors today, a good chance we'll be able to get them started March 16th.
Now, how are the faculty members and the administrative staff on the Ivy Tech Community College campus has been doing in helping make the adjustment to offer more 8-week courses as opposed to the longer 16-week?
Boy, Chris, that is a great question. I cannot say enough good about our faculty and staff. Faculty, as you can guess, you don't just fold it over and teach two lessons in a week. You really have to redesign the course to the learning outcomes, and then think about how can I better align assignments, because you really are in a shorter number of weeks, so you have to think through those assignments and exams in a different way. Our faculty have done a wonderful job. That's why we've taken 3 years to get all the way fully implemented at scale. But our faculty have done a great job in doing that redesign and continuing to fine-tune and tweak it. For those of us who've taught in a classroom, you know it's not just one time and you get it perfect. Every semester, every term, you try to improve it. But it is working, and we'll continue to get better at this approach. And we certainly invite those who've never tried it to give it a shot. We know the majority of our students like the change and are certainly seeing better success.
Well, it sounds like the first step for anybody who's interested in enrolling in classes with Ivy Tech Community College is either come into one of the college campuses in the neighborhood, and here in Northwest Indiana in particular, or by just going online on the Ivy Tech Community College website.
That's exactly it, and certainly we look forward to seeing them. And, of course, our goal is to make sure more Hoosiers have great careers that will bring them success and prosperity, and we're just glad to serve in this role. And Chris, we appreciate you letting us share this story today.
Well, we're glad to be able to do so. That's Dr. Sue Elsperman. She's the president of Ivy Tech Community College. It doesn't matter whether it happened to have been seen from the foxhole or from the cockpit of an aircraft, maybe seen from a ship deck, or maybe even from a mess deck, or even still from a behind-the-scenes office desk. They're all stories that deserve to be told and to be chronicled. And that's what the Veterans History Project is all about. And we have with us the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, now retired, Colonel Karen Lloyd. And Colonel Lloyd, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me. Very much appreciated.
If you will, please take a moment and talk a little bit about the Veterans History Project. How did it get started, and what are some of the general goals that you have?
Well, the Veterans History Project was started in October 2020. It was led by Representative Ron Kine, who had the idea based on a picnic he had had the previous summer with his family when his dad and uncle got together and started talking about their story. And he said, you know, who else out there needs to know these stories? Mm-hmm. And the Veterans History Project really relies on volunteers like your listeners to reach out to the veterans in their lives and their communities to find out what they did, whether it was humorous, whether it was harrowing. It's these stories that are lost to history unless we find out what they are and get them somehow jotted down or listened to and recorded. And that's what we're all about, helping your listeners, volunteers, reach out to those veterans who would otherwise be lost in plain sight.
What do you see as the reason why veteran stories seem to be our stories in general?
I think veteran stories are our stories because they help us understand that these are folks from across all backgrounds, experiences, walks of life, and they have served our country, and they really prove why freedom's not free.
Now, we know that many times this is an opportunity for folks to do a little research, not only about individual research into a family member or maybe somebody from the community that they live in, but just in general, researchers take advantage of this. How does the collection is able to be used as a research tool?
Well, the collection is used by a variety of different folks. I mean, two that really come to my mind. One is Ken Burns, when he did his World War II documentary back in 2008, mm-hmm. and then again when he did his Vietnam documentary in 2017. Both times he used over 200 of our collections to look at stories and listen to stories to see which stories he wanted to use. But what I like best about it is that the veterans keep their copyright with our program, so that Ken Burns had to reach out to these veterans or their heirs and say, I'd like to use your story. Here's how I'd like to use your story. Are you up for it? Another really good example would be Liza Mundy and the book that she wrote, Code Girls, the World War II women who were told, oh, well, just tell them you're a government secretary, and they were the ones that were breaking the codes. And what I'm most pleased about is Liza said, if not for your research librarian and for the materials you had here at the library, I would not have done this book because I wouldn't have thought I had enough materials. And what I'm most pleased about is that last March, we actually had the first national Code Girl reunion here at the library, and we had six Code Girls in their mid-90s come, along with over 40 family members.
Wow.
To talk about what their loved ones did during the war.
Take a second and explain to our listeners, if they're not familiar with the term Code Girl, what does that mean?
Code Girls were the women that were asked, are you going to be engaged, and are you good at crossword puzzles? Mm. And if they weren't going to be engaged and they were good at crossword puzzles, they were breaking the codes. One of the codes that they broke was the Japanese purple box, which allowed us to be successful at Midway. And these women didn't talk to each other. Some of the stories that Liza shared with us that I absolutely adore was she said her husband and her children and her went into an intelligence museum, a spy museum, if you will, and they saw a purple, this coding machine. It was the Japanese equivalent of the Enigma. And she said, oh, well, I guess I can tell you what I did during the war. And his husband says, well, dear, you were a government secretary. And she said, no, Harold, here's what I really did. So she explained to Harold and their grown children what she had done during the war breaking codes, and she had never shared that before because she felt like if she did, that she would go to jail. Wow. And there's a whole group of women whose stories went with them to the grave because they didn't believe they could tell their stories. And we're so grateful for the few that chose to do that. We have over 20, and Liza found even more. But what they did was absolutely amazing, and they got absolutely no recognition for it. They're starting to get recognition now, which is so rewarding to me.
Now, we talked a little bit about the collections that are there available in the Veterans History Project and people that can take advantage of it. First, let's talk first about how veterans and Gold Star families can kind of add to their stories from the collections.
Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned Gold Star Families. 2 years ago, well, and actually 3 years ago, in 2016, the end of 2016, Congress passed a law that allowed us to increase our mission to include Gold Star Families so that we can now hear from the loved ones of those that pay the ultimate sacrifice. Mm-hmm. We have 79 collections now, and it's growing daily. What I'm most pleased about is on Friday, we had a Navy Senior Petty Officer, Keith Sherman, who has been going around the country, and he's collected a Gold Star family story from every state, and he chose to donate them to us here at the Library of Congress and the Veterans History Project, and we couldn't be more pleased about that. And your viewers can go up loc.gov/vets or our email site, vohp@loc.gov, to learn more about what we're doing and you know, email us if what they see there isn't what they want. We will reach out to folks across the nation and provide, at no cost to them, a trained oral historian to help them gain a new skill set. We also have field kits that say how to do it. And if you have a tablet or a smartphone, you're halfway there. And we also have sample questions so that people will have a sense of, you know, how do you do an interview? What are the questions you should be asking? Some of my favorite questions, quite frankly, as a part of that arc of the story, is when you ask the veteran, so how did, why the heck did you sign up? And then followed by, so how did you get from home to that first duty station? And for some vets, it's the first plane ride, train ride, or bus they ever took. And then the most fun, quite frankly, is when you say, and who at that first duty station made the biggest impression on you, made a difference in your life? And they all remember the name. They all say, oh, my God, Sergeant Brown. And then they'll go and talk about it. And their eyes light up because it's something that they probably haven't talked about in an awfully long time.
Colonel Lloyd, thank you for the information. Once again, give us the web address so if anybody wants to find out more about not only what's out there, but also to be able to get the information and contribute to it. What's the address for the Veterans History Project?
Yes, our website is loc.gov/vets with an S.
And we've been talking with retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd. She is the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, which tells stories because veteran stories are our stories, too. Providers increasingly use music to help Alzheimer's and dementia patients. Listening to and even performing music can offer some emotional and behavioral benefits. In Indiana, where the number of patients is expected to increase by nearly 20% over the next 5 years, there are several new programs and opportunities for patients to use music to support memory. Side Effects Public Media's Jill Sheridan tells us about one such project that has participants signing.
On an average day at Prime Life in Richmond, in a northern suburb of Indianapolis, seniors can browse the thrift shop, walk laps around an indoor track, or play bingo.
Please return your bingo cards here.
But on a recent Friday, a different activity was kicking off. This is the first rehearsal for the Song Shape Chorus. It's made up of 28 patients with early to mid stages of dementia and their caregivers. Lauren O'Neill and her mother, Tina Bavona, are part of the group. They say music has always been a part of their lives.
It was something to do. you know.
And you played the accordion.
I played the accordion. Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Oh, my God, for years.
Some research shows patients with dementia can even learn new music. Rick Cobb directs the choir.
Enjoy an afternoon of music.
He says when it comes to memory, music holds a special place.
They may be losing language and comprehension on the left side of the brain. On the right side of the brain, they still retain the ability to sing and to do rhythm and poetry.
There's no proven treatment for Alzheimer's and dementia, and therapy options are limited. Tim Brimmer, professor of music education at Butler University, has been studying the effects of music for people with these conditions.
We believe that music is a prescription. Music can prescriptively, proactively reduce or prevent many of the terrible things that happen when we age.
Brimmer led a state-funded research project that showed personalized playlists for dementia patients helped reduce symptoms including agitation and confusion. He says researchers are learning more about how music helps produce positive brain chemicals like endorphins. His current work is focused on how adding movement could help older Hoosiers.
Imagine that if a person is singing while they're moving, while they're hearing, while they're with other people socializing, it is this bombardment of biopsychosocial stimulation.
Back at Prime Life in Richmond, the Song Shape Chorus is nearing the end of its rehearsal schedule.
Okay. All right.
Rick Cobb, the choir director, says the process has been awesome.
For that mom that's suffering with this disease and the daughter who's brought her mom to rehearsal to be able to connect. And for the mom to say, you know what? Yeah, that's the mom that I knew.
Lauren O'Neill considers herself lucky. The mom she knows is still very present. She reminds her mother, Tina Bavona, of another connection to music.
And my parents owned a jazz club on the Jersey Shore.
Right.
So there was a lot of jazz playing in the house, and my dad really liked opera.
That's right.
A lot of Luciano Pavarotti was playing.
Research suggests that for dementia patients, the music from their youth will have the strongest therapeutic value. Participating in the Song Shape Choir has provided that for Tina.
I'm going to start crying. I just couldn't believe it. When Lauren brought me here, I'm thinking, I'm not going to know anybody. And then I know all that, what's going on with the songs and doing things.
She's able to remember the tune, the words, songs that had connections to her mother. O'Neill says, as a caregiver, the experience has given her more hope in a dementia diagnosis.
It's nice to know that there'll be resources for people who suffer from dementia and their caregivers.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Then we go from, on this winter's day, from music to an icy Kankakee River. There have been some changes that folks who are serious weather watchers about the situation with weather in northwest Indiana should know. National Weather Service office based in Romeoville, of course it's officially known as the Chicago National Weather Service office, has made some changes to the flood impact categories that would affect us on the Kankakee River, basically at Shelby and probably other points too in Lake and Porter counties here in Indiana. Let's find out more about the changes, why they're happening, and what kind of impact it may have for you watching the river levels on the Kankakee River. Scott Lincoln is the senior service hydrologist for the National Weather Service in the Chicago area, and he's joining us from the National Weather Service office. Scott, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, if you will bring us an idea as to the issues that come about when you have to make some changes in some of these categories, and in particular the flood impact categories. What are, I guess, flood impact categories, and why folks who are very concerned about the river levels on the Kankakee River should know about them?
The flood impact categories are just a way that we differentiate the different magnitudes of flooding. They're not really meant to apply to any particular person or any particular neighborhood, but it allows us to, describe in a relative sense different stretches of the river, or one river versus another river, how serious the flooding is. So typically, a minor flood stage would represent when we're starting to get some lower-end life-threatening impact, maybe to roadways or water that's getting near some homes in areas where people typically would be. And as we get more towards the moderate and major categories, that's when we're talking about water in structures or affecting some kind of critical infrastructure. So in the case of the Kankakee River at Shelby, the reason we were making changes, you know, is over time, we're constantly evaluating, you know, what kinds of impacts we see in a flood, just to make sure that our documentation on what gets impacted at a different water level, we're constantly evaluating that to make sure that it's still representative. And, you know, we looked at the Kankakee River at Shelby. We found that it looks like we're calling it life-threatening flooding just a little bit too low. Mm-hmm. And it was a conversation we had with the county and also with the Kankakee River Basin Commission. And we basically came to an agreement that we should raise the level so that we're not sending flood warnings as often, maybe for flooding that's not as serious as it's being made out to be with getting a flood warning.
I guess these changes are having a major impact, I suppose, in a way, on how you forecast how high the river happens to be. You can see it, obviously. Even the untrained eye can drive on, like, U.S. 41 and go down that stretch of highway there as you make the crossover from Lake Inn to Newton counties as you're crossing over on the Kankakee River. And that's a very low area anyway, and it seems when the water's awfully high, it's even higher than usual in that particular spot. So it doesn't always, I guess, represent overall how the river's doing, does it?
The forecast will be the same. So, mm-hmm. you know, when we forecast 12 foot, we're still going to forecast 12 foot. It's not necessarily going to change how it's forecast. It's just changing the way that we describe the flooding happening on that stretch of river. And so for the Kankakee River at Shelby gauge, that's the gauge, with the stretch of river that we are watching when we're looking at that gauge is roughly from Interstate 65 downstream to the state line. So
right.
we're looking at all the areas that are impacted kind of in that stretch of river and tying that back to the Shelby gauge. And so it's just a better way it's a better way to describe, you know, the flooding. And in the previous, about 6 years or so, we were averaging about six flood events a year using the old flood stage. So that means people were getting six flood warnings a year, and that made us kind of question, is this really life-threatening flooding that we want to warn people six times a year? It was definitely it was the location in northeast Illinois and northwest Indiana that had the most flood warnings. And so, you know, that started us to do the review. And in the review, we found that we could probably adjust those levels just a little bit higher so that when we're issuing a flood warning, it's for a little bit more, a little more life-threatening. So the
yeah.
warning really means that's time to take action.
So I guess it makes it more meaningful, I suppose, when the warnings go out there, they're really serious about how the situation is then.
Yeah, that's definitely the goal. You know, we're like I said, we constantly are looking at it. Every time there's a flood event, we go back and look at what things actually flooded, and we make sure it still matches the documentation that we have for that gauge. And, you know, sometimes rivers change, or sometimes people build things or remove things from the floodplain that change what's impacted. And, it's something we're always watching. They were not necessarily meant to stay that way, you know, at a certain level for minor, moderate, or major. It wasn't necessarily meant to stay there forever. And like I said, that's why we constantly are evaluating it to make sure that it's the most meaningful it can be for the community. We obviously don't mm-hmm. want to overwarn, and we don't want to underwarn.
Yeah. We know that the National Weather Service has many, many trained meteorologists and other observers that work out of the office, but you also rely, too, on trained observers out there, people who live in the area, who travel through the area a lot, who are trained in what they're supposed to be looking for. Do you count on a lot of folks in the area there around the Kankakee River to help the Weather Service stay up to date on some of the observations?
Oh, obviously. And then from the hydrology perspective, we actually have another subset of weather spotters that we call river ice spotters.
Mm-hmm.
The Kankakee River sometimes is prone to ice jams, and unfortunately we had several of them this past winter. Being able to track where the ice is and where it is starting to jam up, which may cause flooding concerns, that's really helpful to us because it's a lot of times ice jams happen in small areas and they're between river gauges, so we can't really tell where the flood impacts are going on. It's a much more difficult flood situation than, you know, a rainfall or snowmelt caused flood, which affects the whole river at the same time. So, you know, anyone who lives along the river and wants to share information about any ice jams they're seeing or flooding and You know, and again, in addition to any type of severe weather that they see, we definitely welcome those reports.
And that's Scott Franklin, who is the senior hydrologist at the National Weather Service office in Chicago. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's Micah Bornstein in for John Kane.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and welcome to another edition of Eye on the Arts. My name is Micah Bornstein. I'm filling in for John Kane, and today, joining me in the studio is Bridget Covert, Director of Exhibitions from South Shore Arts, and my colleague as well. Bridget, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Bridget's feeling a little under the weather, so she was gracious enough to come in and talk to us a little bit about the very exciting upcoming exhibition, the Maurice Sendak Memorial Exhibition.
Yes, and it's going to be a great show. We have 50 works by Maurice Sendak, illustrations, and just a lot of fun pieces in the exhibit celebrating the life of Maurice Sendak, and heavily on his most famous book, Where the Wild Things Are. I think most of the work, about 75% of the work, is from that book. So it's kind of fun, and Maurice Sendak wrote that book in, I don't know, the 1960s, but it's kind of had a following since then. So getting all ages in there, from people who have appreciated his book in the past and people who appreciate it now.
There are, of course, a lot of illustrations from Where the Wild Things Are, but there's a few from my personal favorite, which is In the Night Kitchen, including a stunning drawing that I saw through bubble wrap of the young protagonist standing next to an airplane. Bridget, can you tell us a little bit about how this – we're going to talk a little bit about the show and some of the events that go around it happen in conjunction with it, but can you tell us how this show arrived?
Yeah. Well, you had to deal with a little bit more. But we actually booked the exhibit quite a few years ago, so it's been coming in the making. But when we got the exhibit, it came in probably one of the largest crates I've ever seen, which was kind of funny because now it's hidden in the gallery. But it was quite a large case filled – perfectly packaged with Maurice Sendak's work. But it's interesting how that always comes, because it's been traveling for a number of years, I think almost 10 at least now, just to different cities. It's been all over the U.S. and even London. And so it's exciting to have it here in Munster, Indiana.
Yeah, some big name venues. I think it went to the Museum of Science and Industry,
yep,
and one of the Disney locations. I can't remember which one.
I was going to say, it's traveled all over the place through, you know, Chicago and Science and Industry Museum a couple of years ago, and just a bunch of different libraries and exhibition spaces. So, yeah, it's been traveling for a while, and we're excited to have it here.
Well, so people who are familiar with the gallery at South Shore Arts know it's rather large, and 50 works, while substantial, isn't maybe enough to fill the gallery. But there's some exciting things we're doing in conjunction with the events, as well as the presentation of these pieces that you've been working hard on. Can you talk a little bit about all of that?
Yeah. So we've kind of created a little jungle in the gallery, and we're trying to make it coincide with Where the Wild Things Are, where Max, the character in the book, kind of dreams up this really fun little different world of where he travels overseas and into jungles and befriends the wild things. So we've tried to make that come to life a little bit in the gallery. And with it, coming up soon, will be we're hosting a family arts fest, which will be celebrating the exhibit, but not only with South Shore Arts is joining us, it's the Symphony and Theater at the Center and Trauma Catering, and we're putting on this whole big day where people can come and take theater classes, do art workshops. The catering will be doing their brunch and selling food, and there'll be vendors, so it's just going to be a really fun day, you know, at the center for people to kind of see what it's all about there.
Yeah, I want to make sure we emphasize the fact that Bridget's building a small jungle in the gallery, complete with vines and towering palms. So it is going to be quite the spectacle. And Family Arts Day in its own right, I think, is going to be very exciting this go-around. We have, as Bridget mentioned, all those wonderful events and the participation of the entire building. But we also have, I think, an exciting lineup of arts educational activities for families to participate in, to get a real taste of the kinds of classes we have at the South Shore Arts, specifically at our Center for Visual and Performing Arts location. Bridget, the dates, when is this exhibition running?
Yes. Well, the Family Arts Fest is going to be Sunday, February 23rd, starting at 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and then the exhibition for the Marie Sendak show will run all the way through April 12th. So there'll be plenty of time to catch it and see it and explore the exhibit, see all of Marie Sendak's works, and see the jungle we've created in the gallery.
That sounds fantastic. Well, I hope you come out and join us. It's going to be exciting, and I am going to let Bridget go home and get some rest now. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and have a good week.
And join us again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio for another Eye on the Arts conversation. And, of course, this one and all of the Eye on the Arts conversations can be found online on our website at lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.